Hello, and welcome to another episode of Seattle Nice. This time, we are without our capable moderator, so it's going to be chaos this week.
Anarchy.
I'm Erica. It's already starting. I'm Erica Barnett, a Publicola. Here to talk with me is Sandeep Kaushik, political consultant. And we're going to be talking about last week's historic vote on drug law in Seattle and what comes next. So I'm just going to sort of set this up by explaining really briefly what happened. The Seattle City Council, on a surprise vote, slightly surprising vote, decided not to pass an ordinance that City Attorney Ann Davison wanted, allowed the police essentially to arrest people for possessing drugs or using drugs in public. The City Attorney's office and proponents said that it was just putting the local law in line with state law that passed this session, making drug use and possession a gross misdemeanor. And opponents said that it wasn't necessary and that if the King County prosecutor wants to prosecute drug crimes, they can already do that. And so there is a debate over this. The law got voted down on a swing vote with Andrew Lewis casting that deciding vote. And now Mayor Bruce Harrell has set up a task force that's supposed to come up with some sort of plan to make it possible for the law to pass, but also to set up some sort of court system or other alternatives for people who are addicted to fentanyl and need help instead of jail and prosecution. So I'm going to shut up and ask you, Sandeep, what do you think happens next after this very, very busy last week and a half?
Well, first of all, I'm going to say, like, David Hyde better get his ass back from vacation or we're going to end up killing each other. But but beyond that, first of all, this proceedings last week, the session was on Tuesday, and it was pretty dramatic, right? I mean, there was a kind of assumption on the part of a lot of people going in that this law was going to pass, right? And then Andrew Lewis sort of was the swing vote, and that council member, Andrew, kind of really admitted he flipped on the dais. Like, he decided he couldn't vote yes, kind of dramatically voted no, and there was a lot of uproar and fallout in the wake of that. I will say now, a week in since then, I am cautiously optimistic that we will see something positive come out of the wreckage of last week. I've been talking to folks at various stakeholders, key stakeholders in this over the last week, and I think there's a lot more alignment on what a possible fix, coming back with. I think a fix would look like something like, yes, reinstating passing the new state law for gross misdemeanors, but also pairing that with a number of specific targeted reforms that would spell out how people who are addicted on our streets are actually going to be diverted, hopefully towards, better and more effective treatment outcomes than just simply passing a punitive gross misdemeanor law.
Yeah, and here is where we will differ.
Okay.
Because I am incautiously pessimistic.
Okay. Explain
about
why.
This.
Explain why.
Well, the big reason is that, I mean, there's not really a lot of there in terms of, no matter what you sort of propose or whatever they come up with to say, this is the root cause of the fentanyl crisis and here's how we're going to solve it. The fact is, any expansion of solutions, including anything that's existing, like, we do have pre-filing diversion programs for young people, and the city attorney's office is modestly going to expand those to include some older people, but we just don't have the money for the kind of, I mean, even if you're talking about, conventional treatment, if you're talking about buprenorphine, those things require budget line items. The mayor's office is saying they're going to wrap this up and have it all done with a bow on it in a couple of weeks. That is not certainly long enough to plan out all these alternatives and figure out how to fund them. And also, I mean, the mayor's office and Andrew Lewis are saying that they want to create some kind of new court to replace community court, which I think is not a bad idea. I mean, there were criticisms of community court from both sides, from Ann Davison's office and from some service providers. So that would, in theory, be this court that could address these new drug misdemeanors. But, I mean, I don't see how that's going to happen in a short time frame. And in a longer time frame, I don't see a scenario, honestly, where the police are going to be arresting people for using drugs on the street and attempting to jail and charge them, just simply, again, we don't have the resources to do that. I mean, we have a felony drug crime right now, but we had a felony drug crime rather on the books that this is replacing. And the King County Prosecutor's Office rarely ever prosecuted felonies and said that it was a matter of resources. So now you're talking about these lesser crimes of people just sitting around, on the street smoking fentanyl. How is that going to be made a priority? And what are we going to no longer prioritize to use the jail and the courts for that? Just doesn't seem plausible.
So a few things. First of all, like just by way of context, because first, I think it was former prosecutor, King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg, who I think it was in 2018, basically announced that he was going to stop prosecuting. Back then, it was a felony for possession of hard drugs. And, so de facto legal, decriminalize, I guess, is the right term, possession of small quantities of hard drugs on the streets of Seattle because they weren't being prosecuted anyway. I also think, by way of context here, as you mentioned, community court, and one of the things I think that swayed Andrew's vote and flipped him from a yes on the misdemeanor possession public use law to a no was the fact that the city attorney, Ann Davison, had a few weeks ago pulled out of the old community court system that was set up in 2019, right?
And, well, it was a few days before the vote. It was actually a really, poorly planned, unforced error on her part. I think if that is really why Andrew Lewis, I mean, the moment was very dramatic, and he said that he decided on the dais, but then he said it was because of this decision a few days earlier. So who knows?
But it was an unforced error. The confluence of those things at a minimum provided like a strong explanation, I guess, for why the five members of the council voted no, and they certainly cited the pullout from community court. I actually thought you wrote a really good piece and a fair piece, which I don't always think you write about this the other day, which looked at sort of how community court actually worked, right? And I would say that the community court that has now been eliminated was, frankly, a failure and a joke, right? We don't have a community court. I do think, to your point, that leaves a void, right? And if that old community court is replaced by something that's actually focused in a more effective way on addiction and resourced and funded, then we could come out in a much better place than we went in. Now, there's a number of ifs there, but there's potential here.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, the thing that Andrew Lewis pointed to specifically was drug court. And I think that's a really problematic example. And this is something that, that Lisa Dugard would, probably agree with, the head of one of the chief diversion programs in the city. It requires you to plead guilty, and it also it requires enforced abstinence. And if you are not abstinent and you fail too many times, you can't graduate drug court. It's a 10-month program. It's very stringent, mm-hmm. and it's for serious crimes. And I don't see the resources, but I also don't think it'd be just to put people, through this program where, they're set up for failure if they're, deeply addicted to fentanyl and have, are homeless and have other challenges, to put them into a drug court where they're almost destined to fail.
So if that's what they're going to do, I think I mostly agree with you that that's not the right approach. King County does have a drug court right now, right? And basically, drug court is now used for people who are addicted. Nobody's going to drug court for possession or public use of drugs, right? They're being sent to drug court because they're committing felony theft or other felony crimes, right? And then they're sent to drug court and they're told, well, if you get treatment and stay clean, we will wipe your convictions, right? We won't prosecute you for these felony crimes you have committed. That model probably doesn't appropriately apply, at least in that form, to the kinds of folks we're talking about here in a more therapeutic community court alternative setting, right? There has to be some stick to this. Like the old part of the problem with the old community court is that you would get arrested. More than half of the crimes, misdemeanor crimes in the city, you were automatically sent to community court, where at worst, if you showed up for your hearing, you would be sentenced to a 90-minute life.
That's not at worst. That would be at best. I mean, I wrote about the, right. the various levels of community court, and that is the minimal level.
Okay.
There are other right. levels, so I think that's been misrepresented. But I also just wanted to say about diversion. People are, you know, talk about how, oh, we need diversion, yeah. and those programs are totally different than community court. I would suggest looking at some of our diversion programs. They're very low barrier. They are very much like, you know, they're not, you have to complete a 90-minute life skills class, but they're not that far off.
Right.
I mean, it's, you know, it's showing up to a place and, you know, participating in some minimal level. And it's for, you know, generally very high functioning people. And so, again, like, I just think there's this fantasy of these magical diversion programs that are going to come with some sort of stick, as you put it, but also be really involved and, you know, require people to engage for long periods of time. And we just don't, that's not what our diversion programs are mostly like. So it's standing up this whole other system that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, of course, you know, LEAD would say that they are the place for people with higher mental health problems, higher criminal justice involvement. Okay, well then they're always struggling for money. So yeah. we got to fund that. Yeah. It's just, there's a lot of steps between here and there. And that's why I'm not terribly optimistic.
I think that's a fair point. I will say this, part of the reason I think community court, the secret reason community court was so fucking appealing, right? And why so many of the misdemeanor cases in the city of Seattle were diverted to community court was, to your point, it was freaking cheap, right? Like you arrest somebody, you release them immediately, you tell them to go to community court, 80% of the time they don't show up. Then a $25 bench warrant gets issued, which is a farce because they don't enforce it, which is why they had built up a backlog of 1,500 of these warrants. Quote unquote warrants, right?
Well, I mean, if you look at mainstream court, it's right. the same.
Right.
I mean, people are not showing up for their hearings.
Not,
they get
not to the same level.
Them.
This is a
higher
level.
They're a little more money. I mean, it is yeah. a little bit higher. So, again, I have the statistics on my website.
Yeah, yeah,
like
I
published right. about this.
You did, and it was a good piece.
I just don't think, you know, the court system is a very flawed system.
Yeah.
and,
right.
and, you know, a community court is flawed, but so is regular court. And I'll also say Ann Davison's office told me that, you know, their hope with getting rid of community court was actually to free up a judge to go do mainstream court. So there's two sort of at odds plans happening here. There's let's free up this judge to do more mainstream cases, and there's let's free up a judge to do this new therapeutic court.
Right.
So
well,
I just
and they want to
it's
expand,
not a,
and they want to expand pre-filing diversion, right? Which, as they point out, statistically works better. Now they're doing a triage, right, where they're picking certain people to go to pre-filing diversion, right? Pre-filing diversion, just to explain for our audience, means before you're actually ever charged with a crime, you're diverted, you know, into an alternative program, right? And if you meet the terms of that program, you never get a charge on your record, right? You're never.
But it is like, for example, you know, an art program out of West Seattle,
uh-huh.
you know, an art
uh-huh.
therapy
yeah.
program, and you know, the LGBTQ center program, although that's for domestic violence, like that is, you know, life skills classes essentially.
Well, I mean, the 90-minute Zoom thing, I mean, that was kind of farcical, the life, quote-unquote, life skills thing. I mean, being sentenced, even the original version of community court, that in its new incarnation in 2019, you were supposed to do 6 hours of community service, right? That was supposed to be the penalty, but then the pandemic hit, and so they wiped that and replaced it with this 90-minute Zoom class.
Well, I would say that, you know, the argument that Judge Damon Shadid, who was in charge of community court, you know, made to me, and it is a compelling argument, is that, you know, you shouldn't have to work for free in order to access court services. I mean, it's you're saying it's a penalty, but these are people who don't even have charges filed. They haven't been convicted of anything. So, I mean, I hear the argument, but also I don't know what the benefit is of going and picking up some leaves near the courthouse, except to say this is a punishment and we can't punish people that haven't been convicted of a crime.
Well, they're not being convicted of a crime because they're being diverted out. But anyway, I would just say this. My take on the version of community court that I think was a failure, this last version of community court, was that it was built largely around kind of abolitionist principles. And it was all sort of touchy-feely, like, we want you to show up and do this 90-minute Zoom class, but if you don't, nothing's going to happen to you, and we don't, you know. And there needs to be some model that's better than that. Probably not full-on drug court, but there's got to be a happy medium somewhere in between that is built more around harm reduction principles and addiction treatment principles than it is around sort of the public defender sort of, you know, radical abolitionist agenda, right?
That, well, I mean, speaking of abolition, I mean, I think that is, you know, a gross mischaracterization of a very large department in King County of government workers. But but speaking of abolitionism, I mean, Sandeep, do you believe that people should go to jail for using drugs, for just simply using drugs?
I don't.
But that, and so if that becomes the result of this, if in fact, as some proponents have said they want, and I would say Bruce Harrell, you know, has said that he does not want to reignite the drug war, and I tend to believe him, but but a lot, but Ann Davison is saying, you know, in her office is saying, look, there has to be some kind of penalty. You're saying, look, there has to be some kind of penalty.
Yeah,
that consists, the very first thing that consists of is somebody getting arrested for sitting on the street using drugs because they are homeless and getting put in jail, at least for the night.
Well, I mean, first of all, I actually think it creates an opportunity to have a law on the books, creates an opportunity for an intervention at a time when we need, when people are smoking fentanyl and dying on our streets in kind of record numbers, right? I mean, we do really have a fentanyl overdose crisis, right? The replacement of heroin by fentanyl and to some extent cocaine by meth has precipitated a massive spike in overdoses. Yeah, we've talked about this before. Like, I was a junkie, right, in my 20s, and I spent a dozen years shooting heroin, right, speedballing heroin, right? And at the end of it, I kind of walked away from it relatively unscathed. I had some, you know, issues, right? But I was basically able to be an addict for a dozen years and survive it.
And do you think that if you had been arrested or was that the soft touch that you needed to
I think it actually was helpful for me. It didn't make me stop at the time I got arrested. I mean, I stopped for a little while, right? And I had to go through like a court hearing and I got sentenced to 30 days of supervised probation. And I had to go talk to my probation officer who basically asked me not to knock over a gas station within the 30-day period. He's like, so I don't have to deal with the mess. If you're going to rob a gas station, he basically said to me, if you're going to rob a gas station, can you please wait 30 days like before you do it?
Yeah. Well,
I was like, sure, man. All right. I won't knock over a gas
station. I'll mark my calendar.
Yeah. But I do think it was a wake-up call, you know, and it was.
And that's great for you. I mean, which I guess is also why I would suggest evidence-based solutions. But I guess I'm asking more like, you know, broadly speaking, you're saying it'll give people an opportunity to intervene. Cops are like the least effective at intervening in a positive way in someone's life who is addicted to drugs. I mean,
it's not the cops that we want them. We want them. That's why.
But that's literally who's going to arrest people and haul them to jail.
But if we create a mechanism where they're not funneled into the criminal system, but going to a court that's specifically focused on trying to get them help for their addiction, it wouldn't mean on your first offense, like, oh, you screw up
you're going to go to jail. People who are using fentanyl in public are using fentanyl a dozen times a day or more. I mean, it's not like your second offense would take very long to come if you are living downtown and the cops know you. So I think that's a little bit of a cop-out. And fundamentally,
I think there has to be some friction.
Fundamentally, I think in your heart, Sandeep, I think you are in favor of decriminalization. I think somewhere in there you believe this.
I do. I am in favor of decriminalization, but with this caveat.
This is literally criminalization. It's creating a law in the city of Seattle that has never existed before.
With this caveat, I'm in favor of, I don't think people should go to jail simply for the act of using drugs, even hard drugs. That said, if you're going to do that, I think you really do then have to take seriously the downstream negative social impacts created by people who are addicted. In other words, you can't then also be saying, and we'll use addiction as an excuse for the fact that you're stealing every day from your local Target or whatever, right? And we're just going to blow that off.
But those things are already crimes. Those things are already crimes.
But we practically stopped prosecuting a lot of that stuff too. And then that creates a kind of vicious downward spiral, right? If people are using fentanyl 12 times a day, sitting in the bus shelter, right? First of all, I think there needs to be an intervention with those people. I think leaving them there to do that is not a solution to the problem. And secondly, I don't think that intervention should be immediately punitive, but I think you've got to work those people towards a better outcome. And I don't think people are going to come in from the cold on their own. I with my experience of opioid addiction, if you had made it easy for me to continue to using opioids, I would have kept using them and I never would have stopped.
Well, and this is why anecdotes are not data, because I was addicted to what I consider to be a hard drug that we don't consider a drug, which is alcohol. And, you know, you withdraw from that and you can die.
I'm having bourbon right now.
it's a serious fucking drug, though.
Yeah.
And for me, I was very lucky. I was never arrested, even though I was committing crimes all the time. You know, if drinking in public was considered a gross misdemeanor, I would have gotten arrested all the time. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. Or just gotten incredibly lucky because it's easier to hide than fentanyl.
Yeah.
And that would not have been helpful for me. That would have actually been tremendously disruptive.
Yeah.
I think there's ample evidence to suggest, I would say to demonstrate that jail is not the front door. It's not the right front door to meaningful treatment. And if your idea is that, well, let's just make it the right front door, I think that is significant hurdle. I think it would be better to create other front doors. And more to the point, we don't have treatment for people.
Right.
So,
well, first of all, I don't think it should be the front door. And secondly, this is the thing I was saying about community court, right? The thing about it was super cheap and there wasn't anything that was really happening and there weren't real interventions happening with these people and they weren't being kind of pushed towards treatment because there, as you say, that the treatment regime was not even available, right? So I don't think this works without a really significant infusion of new resources, right? That's at least a prerequisite for this happening. And that will take some time to set up. Nonetheless, I do think in a relatively short period of time, in the next few weeks, they could come forward with an outline of a plan and a new model that would be oriented towards setting up a therapeutic court that's focused on addiction, you know, outlining what the rules of the game are going to be for that. Outlining what the necessary resources are going to be to make that court functional and effective, and then obviously working on actualizing that is going to take a lot longer, right? But
here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Do you think that's going to happen, given what we have seen from this administration, you know, both the Harrell administration and the Davison leadership at the city attorney's office so far?
I don't know, but this, I go back to being, I'm going to say I'm still cautiously optimistic here because I've certainly heard from people like Andrew Lewis, who was the swing vote last week, and folks in the city attorney's office, who both sides of that conversation have told me that they've found an enormous amount of alignment about how to get together and move something forward. Now, as we both know,
feeling we're talking to the same people.
We probably are, but
different reactions.
But as we both know, the mayor stepped in on Monday, and I think there was criticism of the mayor last week for when you had a vote this big and consequential, right? About are we going to, you know, have this misdemeanor drug law or not. I think there was criticism of the mayor, probably fair criticism, saying, why don't we know what your position on this is, right, going into that vote, right? Where are you, you know, Mr. Mayor, on this big consequential issue? And the fact was, we didn't really know, right? I remember on the day of the vote, I was, confused, like, I heard rumors the mayor's maybe against the bill, maybe he's for it. I don't, you know, who knew? So I do think the mayor has now stepped up on, you know, had that press conference on Monday. I would hope that this 24-member, you know, stakeholder panel that was announced on Monday, I worry that it might be a little unwieldy. And, you know, what you don't want is to convene another process that sort of trundles along endlessly and turns into mush, right? I mean, I think that's the fear, right? That you get nothing at the end or unravels. But hopefully, given what I'm hearing about alignment on a path forward from at least a number of the key stakeholders, hopefully in a relatively short period of time, we could see something productive come out of it. I think we're in wait and see mode.
And I feel like, and I don't know if we talked about this at the time, but I feel like this is the same argument that people were making. They were saying, you know, when the heroin task force got together, that was not the name of it. I think it was the opiate addiction task force.
Yeah, which was 2016, and it was a King County, Seattle joint task force that was created. Yeah.
Yeah. They unanimously voted to adopt a number of policies countywide. And one of those policies, the most controversial, was safe consumption sites for drugs.
Yep.
And at the time, I, you know, am always pessimistic, you know, just as a reporter and somebody who watches this shit, like, you know, cycle around and around over the years, you know, I just thought they're never going to do it. They're never going to be able to cite these things. There's always going to be pushback. And as it turned out, even in Seattle, we never managed to do it. We funded it year after year, and various mayors and various councils just took no action. I am worried that the same thing is going to happen with this proposal or any meaningful aspect of this proposal that is actually harm reduction based as opposed to punitive.
I think there's a risk there, right? I mean, going back to the opioid task force, right? It never happened, despite the fact that both the then mayor and the King County executive stood there when the task force recommendations were announced and said publicly that they were going to do a safe consumption site, right? And then
the fucking mayor of Auburn. I mean, it was a broad like group of people that do not always agree on things.
And so, just in terms of disclosure, I worked on that issue first on the. There was going to be a campaign, right? Because there was immediately a rebellion in the suburbs where a bunch of suburban city councils voted to ban a safe consumption site. And then there was an effort to put a countywide measure on the ballot to ban safe consumption sites. So I was, first of all, involved in that campaign. But then I did a bunch of pro bono work after that, trying to get a safe consumption site funded and opened in Seattle. To your point about funding, the city council appropriated some money for this, but not enough to actually open and operate a safe consumption site. So that money sort of sat there.
That's not why it sat there. Talked about having a van. That never even happened. And that's like the lightest touch you can imagine.
There's a whole episode we could do about why a safe consumption site never happened. And yes, it was frustrating because I was working pro bono trying to get it going. And we couldn't get it past the at that point, the Durkin administration, right? And there were issues about turf and money, and there were and the Trump administration made threatening noises saying they would shut down anything that Seattle did. But there was also, I think, just emotional resistance to doing it on the part of some electeds, even though intellectually they may have been there on that, you know, ended up being a bridge too far. Now, I think there's even more need now, not just for a safe consumption site, but I think we do need an opioid overdose recovery site. And again, I'm cautiously optimistic on that front, too. There are very productive conversations happening right now between the city and the county and social services providers, including DSC, where I'm involved on the board, about funding and siting an opioid overdose recovery center. And I think that conversation is moving forward at a remarkably fast and positive clip. So I'm optimistic that we'll see.
We'll talk about that in a year when it doesn't, or in 2 years when it doesn't happen. I mean,
we'll see.
It was remarkable at the time when everybody agreed that there should be two safe consumption sites in King County, one in Seattle and one in another community. It was hailed. I mean, it was this remarkable breakthrough.
Yeah.
And it never even started to move. It moved a little bit in the city of Seattle, and all these suburban communities rejected it.
Yeah. The council appropriated $1.2 million, which then sat there for a while. And then
for years. Durkin let it sit there. And particularly with the current, you know, mayor and city council, and particularly the people who have, you know, Ann Davison, Sarah Nelson, and Alex Peterson, who is leaving at the end of this year, proposing this. I mean, I don't think that what you're describing is their vision. I think Sarah Nelson's vision, because she's described it really clearly, is to put people in jail and give them the choice to go into residential treatment, which she has proposed funding, and which is incredibly not only ineffective for people with fentanyl addiction and opiate addiction, but like it is actually contributes to deaths when people leave.
Right.
So, you know, I just
I think it's
you know,
more
you
diverting
do have
people towards and getting them on opioid addiction. The one, well, believe me, kicking opioids is a brutal, brutal, brutal thing. I do not recommend it to anybody. I've done it a million times, and it was horrible every time. But unlike, say, meth, at least we have chemical interventions, right? Stuff like Suboxone that are fairly effective at actually treating opioid addiction. And so I do think there are opportunities for intervention that are plausible that don't necessarily involve putting somebody in jail, right?
I mean, I will say that this is the other reason, the sort of overarching umbrella reason that I'm pessimistic about this is because we are not solving the root causes that, you know, that contribute to somebody self-medicating because they're living on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even the solution of Suboxone, it's really hard to get somebody on a daily regimen of Suboxone if they are homeless and can't be reached because they're being swept from place to place. And that is a real issue right now today. So, you know, there is not a serious conversation, I don't think, think, about investing the kind of resources in all that stuff that, like, I think, you know, law and order type people like to dismiss as, you know, is too big or not the point. But it is exactly the point that you cannot effectively treat someone's addiction if you're not treating the conditions of their life as well. And so, I mean, it's great to say, and I am glad that we have medical interventions that are not, you know, going to the methadone clinic every day, mm-hmm. but,
which I did,
you know,
right?
And people still do this. Every day, right? Sure. but it is tremendously difficult to do that when you are homeless and your life is, you know, a swirl of chaos.
Yeah.
And so I just think, and we're not talking about any of that. We're talking about a court that's going to get people into the treatment, that's going to, you know, get people into sobriety. And I think there's just this magical thinking
and hopefully connect them to other services aside from treatment,
but we know that there's not enough housing, we know that there's not enough shelter. These are things that need resources, yeah. And so when people say we're going to connect to services, I feel like
you should be waving around Mark Doan's like $11 billion report right now.
Look, I did not agree with a lot of the spending priorities in that proposal, which included, you know, massive investments in parking lots for RVs for people to kind of live permanently there. But you know, it is a really expensive problem. And I think people say services and they don't always think about what they actually mean by that and what that would entail. And I think people think the services are already there and people just don't want them. And so until we get beyond that point, I can't be optimistic that people are actually going to get better through this criminalization plan combined with some kind of new, you know, pretrial diversion and a new therapeutic court.
Yeah. We'll see. Look, I think Andrew Lewis, who is up for re-election again this year, is certainly motivated. He said on the dais, I may be throwing my seat away by taking this vote. And I do think...
I thought that was a little dramatic.
It's a little dramatic, but I actually think when you look at the public mood right now, I think a lot of people looked at that vote and said, oh my God, here we go again. This is the classic city council doing the bumper sticker, oh my God, we can't have the war on drugs, so we're not going to do anything, right? I think Andrew and others, the mayor, the city attorney, they all, the ball's in their court, and they better do something, all right? If you didn't want that last law just as a standalone, then what's your alternative? And if you fuckers need to get your shit together and figure it out. And if they don't, I think they'll all pay a price.
All right, I'm going to let you have the last word, and I think we can end it there.
Get it together, fuckers.
That was Sandeep Kalshik. I'm Erica C. Barnett. That's it for another episode of Seattle Nice, edited by Quinn Waller. Thanks, everybody, so much for donating on our Patreon page. It's patreon.com/SeattleNice. You can find us on Twitter at RealSeattleNice. And if you want to advertise or just reach out to us, you can reach us at RealSeattleNice@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening.